During the peak of a brutal afternoon commute, when smog oppressively cloaked the sun, I had been passing alone through a singularly dreary tract of suburb, and at length found myself, as the commute wore on, within view of a melancholy Budweiser beer plant, which led me to wonder what happened to cause the fall of the House of Bush.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 722nd edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Frankfurt who are tuned in as we stream along on the radio page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Folks, here's a happy fact. The United States is the world's most profitable beer market. And here's a sad fact. The United States no longer owns its beer industry. These facts, happy and sad as they are, lead us to ask, how did Budweiser become the king of beers? Just think about it. One beer becomes the king of beers. Why did the Bush family sell its Budweiser beer for mere cash? You know, $52 billion is a lot of money, but given the way the government's spending money, that $52 billion might not buy 52 Budweisers in another few years. So why did they give something real for something like cash? And finally, what does the takeover of the American beer business by foreign interests say about American business? Here to help us find some answers today, we have Julie McIntosh, who is the author of Dethroning the King. Julie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you aboard. You have an MBA in business, and you're a business writer for Financial Times?
That's right. Actually, I do not write for the Financial Times at this point because I have gone whole hog into the book authorship career, which has been really nice. But I covered mergers and acquisitions, corporate mergers and acquisitions, mm-hmm. for the Financial Times newspaper for several years and was on that beat when the takeover of Anheuser-Busch occurred.
What fascinated you about the takeover of Anheuser-Busch that led you to focus so intently on it as you have?
Well, in the beginning, it was more of a situational reason. The takeover occurred in the summer of 2008. Basically, it only lasted a month, the takeover battle, and Anheuser-Busch capitulated very quickly for an M&A transaction of this size. Sometimes it takes a year for a company that's an unwilling target to give in, if they give in at all. But they basically gave up the ghost within the span of just a month, and at the time, the whole world financially was falling apart. People were losing their homes. People were losing their jobs. In June of 2008, the country of America was worried about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac going under. So no one was really paying attention to the loss of Budweiser, this American icon. And I discovered after a few months post the deal that there were still so many people in this country who didn't know that Budweiser was no longer American. And in looking at all those things and realizing there was also a lot of unexplored dirt and just interesting information surrounding what happened behind the scenes and the Bush family and the relationship between August Bush III, one of the CEOs of the company, and then his son, August Bush IV, I knew there was a wealth of information that was untapped.
Which led to a very interesting story, Dethroning the King, and a wonderful read. Now, I'd like to start this off by talking about exactly how the Bush clan, the Anheuser-Busch company, you know, made its beer Budweiser the king of beers. And as a young kid, I can remember a 4th of July rodeo parade at Red Lodge, Montana, and the Budweiser beer wagon was there. And my uncle, Walt Linderman, was a famous rodeo guy, so he conjured to get my little sister up on the Budweiser beer wagon where she rode in the 4th of July parade. And you know, the big Clydesdales were pulling the red wagon, and it was really spectacular stuff. So that was very intimate kind of marketing. And you know, you go from there to the Super Bowl ads where you have the three frogs croaking out Budweiser. Well, they just became the... Were they awful clever marketers? Was that what happened?
Yes. And frankly, I, in a lot of ways, view Anheuser-Busch, at least the old Anheuser-Busch, as almost more of a marketing company than an actual beer production company. Clearly, they produce beer, and the quality control and the quality of the beer was very important. But the people within the company understood that marketing was really where it was at in terms of them being able to secure this, you know, Budweiser status as the king of beers and such an American icon and be able to continue to trade off that. So they marketed, as you say, on a very grassroots level. They had many teams of Clydesdale horses that would travel around to parades around the country. I actually grew up in northern Michigan and remember seeing the Clydesdales at parades up there, too.
Mm-hmm.
But then they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on national advertising for the biggest sporting events you can think of, and even local sports. Sporting was incredibly key to them. So your local softball league might have been sponsored by Budweiser. They sponsored ping pong tournaments. They actually spent about $500 million every year on marketing.
Very serious business right there.
Absolutely. That's, and so if you're in advertising or marketing, that was one of the dream accounts to work for, one of the dream companies to work for with all that money at your fingertips.
And there was a lot of money almost everywhere, too. They were ubiquitous in their efforts to brand Budweiser as the king of beer. You know, I read somewhere that beer is America's the most profitable beer market in the world. Why would that be?
Beer is, I think, easier to sell in certain ways in America because, especially in the light lager side of things, which is the type of beer that Budweiser and Bud Light, Miller, Coors are, I would say, and this is just my own view, but I think that Americans are a little bit less discriminatory, and the craft beer thing has only really taken off over the past decade or so. Whereas in Europe, you've got such a long craft brewing tradition and probably a more fragmented market to a certain extent. But one of the reasons it is the most profitable market is because of Anheuser-Busch and how it turned a product that is able to mass produce into something that commands a pretty significant premium just because of the name and the images it evokes and the fact that people think that when they go to a barbecue, they're supposed to drink Budweiser, so they'll pay for that.
And they get a hefty premium. I read somewhere that one of the beer companies was making a gross profit of 70%.
It wouldn't surprise me, but I'm not familiar with every beer company's answer.
Right, right. That's my best. That's a huge profit margin.
Oh, yeah.
Yay.
It absolutely is. And that's not something you can do straight off the bat. But over time, once you refine the production process and get your name out there and are an established brand, absolutely. You know, as long as grain prices don't rise too much and hops, for instance, you can ride the wave.
Well, And you spoke earlier of an older Busch company, which connotes there must be a newer Busch company. What would the difference between the two be?
Well, the company as it has been taken over and merged with InBev is very different from the Anheuser-Busch that most of us still think of when we think of Anheuser-Busch. Pre-late 2008, the old Anheuser-Busch was very, you know, heavy spending, private jets, just everything being gold-plated, spending as much as necessary on raw materials and on personnel. The company had actually never enacted any sort of layoff for budgetary or other reasons.
So it was sorely lacking in penny pinchers.
That's correct. But because their performance was so strong and because their margin was so wide, shareholders were willing to put up with a lot of that lack of discretion in terms of spending because they knew that at some point in the future, if necessary, it could be cut. But right now, they were doing okay. So as the economy started to worsen and Budweiser's fortunes continued to sort of flag a little bit, that was when InBev jumped and saw Anheuser-Busch as a target. Right. And so post the deal, the new Anheuser-Busch InBev is much more formulaic. InBev had a reputation as the Walmart of brewers because they're incredibly cost conscious. And there's a big clash of cultures between the two companies. And they're still kind of rectifying some of those issues 2.5 years later.
Well, I would assume so because you have a culture of people who are spending richly because there are riches to spend, and then a corporation that's used to pinching every penny, and then the two meet, and here we go. Well, we've got to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to go back and talk about the old Bush company and the family that controlled it and how they controlled it for so long. 150 years is an incredible length of time to hold a company together. You look around these days, and not many companies have lasted 150 years under a family. So let's talk about that. I want to talk about it with Julie McIntosh, author of Dethroning the King. And the king, of course, is Budweiser Beer, the king of beers. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, your host today. We're looking at the Budweiser Beer Company, or Anheuser-Busch, or whatever it's called these days, and we're trying to figure out what the fall of the House of Bush means for American business, what it portends. Right back to stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, it was the king of beers and family business for over 150 years. And the Anheuser-Busch Company and, of course, Budweiser Beer. Rumor has it that the young Bush babies, Bush family babies, were all anointed with, five drops of Budweiser beer to get them going early in their lives. And that's where they were to head. And it all headed fine until 2008. And then Budweiser sold itself to Invest Corporation, a Brazilian-controlled corporation, marking, of course, the essential collapse of the American beer industry. It's all gone. America no longer owns its own beer industry. It's all owned by foreigners now. So that's the story we're working with today. We're working with the author of Dethroning the King, the story of the hostile takeover Anheuser-Busch, by Julie McIntosh. Julie, is it true that the young Bush babies were all anointed with some Budweiser to get them going?
The male babies were given five little droplets of beer directly into their mouths from a little medicine dropper before they even had milk. So both August Bush III and his son August Bush IV, who was running the company when it was taken over, had beer before they had milk when they were born.
So it was quite a family dynasty. What about the early Bushes? Who were they, and how did they get this all going?
Well, it's a German family. Mm-hmm. They had emigrated over here, and the founder of the company actually married into the brewing business. His father-in-law had just decided to start up a small little brewery in St. Louis, and he paired up with him, and they went into business together. And this is at the time when the beer business was incredibly fractionalized because there wasn't refrigerated trucking or train transportation. So if you wanted beer, you had to buy it from someone relatively close to you.
Close by, right.
And actually, over the years, Anheuser-Busch was the first company to use refrigerated shipping to move its beer longer distances. And then the company actually also was the first one to figure out that if it had breweries scattered around the country, it would really cut down on some of those shipping costs. So they built a brewery, aside from the one in St. Louis, the next one was in Newark, New Jersey, and then they ended up with a good couple handfuls of them scattered around the country.
They always seem to be in these really dreary tracts of suburbs. And, you know, whenever I see a Anheuser-Busch brewery, they always are so depressing. I don't know why they came up with that notion of putting them right next to the freeway. where the scenery isn't too cool, but that's what they did. So how did the Augustus Bush III then took over this company that was pretty well on its way then, right?
Right. The company, when Augustus III took over, was run by his father, whose nickname was Gussie. And he was a marketing genius, a glad hander, you know, friend of all men sort mm-hmm. of character. And very
here, you want a beer?
Yeah, outgoing and effervescent. The people of St. Louis loved him, but he got into his mid to late 70s and was still running the company. And it became clear to many people, including his son, that he was losing some of the mental sharpness he needed to continue to run Anheuser-Busch, but he wasn't willing to give up the CEO's position. So August the 3rd actually threw his father out in a very messy coup that resulted in the two men not speaking for a decade afterward.
Oh, and thus precipitated the reign of the 3rd. They called him what? The first, the second, the third, and the fourth in the company?
So. It really was just the third and the fourth, because the second was Gussie, and they called him Gussie or Junior. Gussie. So the third and the fourth are the two who got those fun royal acronyms.
Okay, the third. So your story, Dethroning the King, really focused a lot on the conflict between the third and the fourth. So we may as well go there right now and talk a little bit about that, because, of course, that is an element in all family businesses. How do you get along with a domineering parent or a recalcitrant child and keep the business on track and moving forward? The third, Augustus Bush the Third, was a very domineering person, as I understand it from your story.
Unbelievably controlling and micromanaging and on top of everything. To some degrees, that was a fault because he was incredibly difficult to work for, but he was also a spectacular CEO in terms of driving the company's performance. He built Anheuser-Busch to a company that had 52% of the American beer market,
wow,
which is just an astronomical sum. And I really attribute a lot of that, after doing my research and my interviews, to him and to his vision. Work was his life. And so the negative of that was that his relationship with his family suffered pretty substantially. He was divorced from August the 4th's mother when the 4th was about 5 years old, and the 4th rarely saw his father outside of work. So not surprisingly, for a young boy looking for some attention from his dad, he started spending more and more time at the office, decided to throw himself into the business too. And, you know, a lot of that was really, I believe, in order to win his dad's approval in some way, because that was not an easy thing to do.
Sure.
The third was very, very stingy in doling out praise, and that included with his son. So the fourth began working at the company from a young age as well. Both the third and the fourth started in relatively menial jobs, you know, sweeping floors, stacking barrels, that sort of thing, and worked their way up through the ranks.
I want to take you back a little bit because of a statistic that you quoted that just flabbergasted me. 52% of the beer market in the United States went to one beer.
Well, one brewery.
One company, one
right,
brewery.
Right, right. But yeah, and a vast yes. majority of that did go to Budweiser, of course, because Budweiser is the most popular, and Bud Light. And then you've got Michelob, for instance, and a few others. But right, in 2001, when we were right in the throes of the tech bubble and then the burst of the tech bubble. That was right around the time when Anheuser-Busch hit 52%. So more than one out of every two beers we were drinking while we were programming our computers was an Anheuser-Busch beer.
You know, I bet that would make a remarkable percentage of the gross calorie intake of the country, if you think about it.
Yes.
52%, an incredible company then, and a very profitable company. But it doesn't sound like... though Augustus III, Bush III, was a very incredibly bright business person, that he was too focused on the margin. Because it seems like while he was intent on building the brand name up and the volume up, costs weren't a very big concern of his, right?
That's right. But there are kind of two sides of that coin. And... One way of looking at it is that he was either just lazy on costs or unwilling to accept the growing realities of the new you know, American business culture, that you shouldn't be spending all this money on private jets and helicopters and compounds for off-site conferences and things like that. But he knew that his shareholders were pretty happy with the company's performance as it was. And so if you, as long as you keep your shareholders happy, sometimes CEOs think you might as well save some of those extra options like cost cutting for a rainy day or for an emergency. If you run out of other ways to grow the company, other ways to improve things, then you start cutting costs. So, you know, that's part of the strategy of some CEOs. I will say, though, that when his son took over, and it became very clear by 2006 that Anheuser-Busch needed to cut costs, his son tried mightily to do so in a variety of ways, and his father really pushed back hard, including on some things that were arguably pretty ridiculous to even think the company should spend money on, such as incredibly expensive private jets that flew all the way to China without stopping. You know, the third wanted to take delivery of one of those jets, and his son said, "This is ridiculous. The shareholders are looking for us to cut expenses right now. We can't accept this unbelievably expensive jet." And his father was very upset about that. So the fourth canceled delivery of the plane behind his dad's back. And that was one of the biggest fights between the two of them. So they were spending their time on this rather than running company.
So here we have one of the most productive and profitable companies in the United States in terms of just money that's coming in. And yet the two people that are running it, or de facto running it, the third and the fourth, are at each other's throat, father and son. And then what's going to happen? Well, here comes the foreign invaders. This is The Food Chain, Michael Olson with Julie McIntosh, and you right back. Do stay tuned. Well, here's a fact. The United States is the most profitable beer market in the world. And here's another fact. The United States no longer controls or owns its own beer industry. Gone. The foreigners have come and bought us out, and now we're just beer drinkers. But how did it happen? That's the story today. We're talking to Julie McIntosh, the author of Dethroning the King. 2008, pretty strange time in American business, correct, Julie? Let's see, here I got a... There, Julie got you now.
It was one of the most difficult years we've ever had. In 2007, 2008, the housing market was blowing up and people were losing their jobs. People were worried about their local bank closing up shop and them not being able to get money out of an ATM. And that's the environment in which InBev made its hostile bid for Anheuser-Busch in June of 2008.
What a great property to pick off, right?
It was. It was a company that InBev has had its eye on for quite a long time. And it really was a crown jewel of the brewing industry. Everyone worldwide, people know Budweiser. And that brand just has such cachet that InBev knew it'd be able to trade off that brand equity for quite a significant length of time.
And who is InBev then?
InBev is a company that was created in a merger of its own. There was a company called Interbrew based in Belgium and a company called AmBev based in Brazil. And so although they basically adopted the sort of we're a Belgian company mantra, it's really run by the Brazilians, who were part of the half of the company that was Brazilian. These are a group of very, very savvy businessmen, American MBA educated. They went to Stanford Business School, to Harvard Business School, and they have had designs on creating this global beer juggernaut since the early 1990s. I have stories in the book, and I uncovered information about meetings they actually had with August Bush III of Anheuser-Busch in 1991, where they said, "Let's join forces. Let's become the Coca-Cola of brewers. We know we can do this on a global level." And August Bush looked at them like they were crazy. And then they came back 17 years later and did it.
It swooped in and picked them up and took them away. Julie McIntosh, was the United States really the source of this corporate form of business governance?
In what way?
Well, you speak of InBev as being, you know, American-educated corporate chieftains. And I'm just wondering if the United States was the one that really refined the corporate form of doing business, or does it predate us?
Well, I would say in this particular case, the way InBev does business is partly the type of incredibly efficient, you know, organizational structure. Here's how you run a really tight ship mentality that you can learn in American business schools. But then these Brazilian businessmen really have taken it up a notch, and they are fans of extreme standardization and measurement. So rather than just looking at someone's performance and thinking over the course of a year, yeah, you know, she's done a really great job this year, we're going to give her X amount of a bonus, they would have qualified and quantified everything so heavily throughout the course of the year that by the end of the year, like, a very specific number would spit out. They're just numbers people. And that's where some of the big culture clash between the two companies comes in, because Anheuser-Busch never did that sort of thing.
So Anheuser-Busch is just kind of the opposite kind of company. So here the two are staring each other at a time when the American industry is collapsing, and Anheuser-Busch is trying to figure out where it's going, and InBev is looking at them going, I know where you're going. You're coming to me. How did Anheuser-Busch react to this marriage proposal?
They were not excited about it, to say the least. I've got some great stories in the book about how various people at Anheuser-Busch first found out about the bid. Initially, it was a rumor, actually, that was reported in the Financial Times, the newspaper I was working for. That was right over Memorial Day weekend, and there was a rumor that InBev was going to make a bid to buy the company for $65 a share, which would have been $46 billion. And these Anheuser-Busch executives went home that Friday, and instead of having a relaxing Memorial Day weekend, barbecuing with their families, everything that they had planned, they spent it at these barbecues in sort of hushed conversations with their colleagues, saying, do you think this is really going to happen? Is this really it? Because there had long been rumors, mm-hmm. and Anheuser-Busch knew it was vulnerable because they were sort of floundering at this point. Then a couple weeks later, InBev made the bid official, and it was a terrifying time for a lot of people at Anheuser-Busch, because they readily admit, even the very top executives at the company readily admit to me that they were living in a state of denial for years. And this sort of hubris and naivete, thinking that, well, we're Anheuser-Busch, we brew Budweiser, how could any other company consider buying us? We're just invincible. And some of that was a little bit of a local, provincial mentality that you find in St. Louis. But a lot of it was just this way of thinking that was ingrained into the culture by, in particular, August Bush III, who we are
the king of beers.
Exactly. And he turned his back on a lot of what was going on globally and basically just ignored the fact that these other brewers were becoming huge overseas.
And then, so he just ignored that and kept focusing on being the king of beer here in the world's most profitable beer market, and because that meant that he was still king. How did this bid by InBev go with the third and the fourth in that conflict between father and son?
It made it neither more difficult nor better, because their relationship was already quite tenuous. Once the fourth started as CEO in 2006, the third basically undermined every attempt his son made to try to become a CEO who was able to enact change in any way. The third wouldn't let his son appoint other high-ranking executives that he wanted. He actually, even though his son was CEO, the third got a bunch of his son's loyalists and other people who were executives immediately beneath him fired. And somehow his son allowed for that to happen, even though his dad was just a board member by that point. The intimidation was very strong there. So August the 4th had very few people to lean on, and his dad was basically pulling his strings like a puppet behind the scenes. So their relationship was so difficult that basically the third just became more powerful once InBev made its bid and asserted himself even more in the boardroom, and the fourth just slowly receded into the shadows and by the end rarely made a comment in a board meeting.
Describe the end.
Anheuser-Busch got very close to actually doing a different deal that would have, in hindsight, probably saved the company. The fourth and his team of deputies decided that they wanted to approach Grupo Modelo, the Mexican brewer of Corona and and Negro Modelo and a variety of other beers. Anheuser-Busch already owned half of Modelo, and they decided, we're going to approach Modelo and see if we can buy the other half of the company, and in doing so, make Anheuser-Busch and Modelo combined too big for InBev to buy. You know, if we're a fish, we swallow another fish, and we become a fish that's too large for InBev to digest and too big for them to get the money, to borrow the money to pay for the deal.
Hold that story. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to find out what happened when Busch tried to buy the rest of Modelo to fend off InBev. It's the big fish eating the bigger fish until somebody's too big to get eaten. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson right back with Dethroning the King, Julie McIntosh, and the Budweiser. What happened to the House of Busch? Right back. Well, so why did the House of Busch try to sell its Budweiser beer, the king of beers, for mere money? That's the question on the table today as we talk with Julie McIntosh, author of Dethroning the King. Julie, we're talking about the final days of Anheuser-Busch Corporation and its ownership of Budweiser and related beers. And to fend off the big invest, they tried to buy the rest of Modelo and thus become even too big. But something happened. What was that? They're right here.
And on a deal with Modelo, they got to the point where the deal was essentially being drafted in a press release. And this is right over the 4th of July weekend in 2008. And they were just getting everything buttoned up, trying to figure out where they wanted to announce it. The Mexicans were on board. The Americans were on board. And then there was one final board meeting for Anheuser-Busch. And August the 3rd, the father basically stood up in that board meeting and made a very vocal, very strenuous presentation, shooting down all of the rationale for that deal. And by the end of the meeting, the company, the board members, decided that they had to go back to InBev before they decided to buy Modelo, go back to InBev and say, we need your best and final offer because we've got this other option on the table. And that led to them striking a deal with InBev within just a few more days because InBev decided to raise its offer to $70 a share.
$52 billion.
That's right.
So they sold the company and it's gone. What happened to the Busch clan when they sold their beer?
Well, one of the most interesting things, and one of the things that would probably surprise most people in this country, is that the Busch family actually had very little presence at Anheuser-Busch. Only a few Busch family members worked there. Those were basically the CEO, his father, and his stepbrother for a while. And the family, the Busch family as a whole, owned less than 4% of Anheuser-Busch.
Wow.
So from a financial standpoint, while most people would probably have assumed that the Bushes certainly owned at least a majority, if not 90%, they owned less than 4%, which is why they had no real control over what happened to the company once InBev made its offer.
So then the board of directors looked at the big bucks that InBev was putting on the table and said, sorry, 4, and so sorry, 3, you're out of the ballpark now.
Right, but interestingly enough, while August the 4th was very much against the deal, one of the things I uncovered in my research and my interviews was that August Busch the 3rd actually was in favor of selling the company and was the kind of like the key vote in deciding to sell it from beneath his son.
Wow.
Which is something that shocked a lot of people in St. Louis and globally when they found out about it. I've gotten a lot of feedback on that.
So what happened then to Budweiser Beer and the company that makes it?
Well, it's still there.
I mean, it's going to be going through some changes, right?
Absolutely. InBev, just in terms of the way they run businesses, everyone knew that they were going to cut significant costs the day they took over. So there were some pretty substantial layoffs, not only in St. Louis but elsewhere. And they have refined a lot of processes. They haven't changed the formula or anything like that, but they have certainly cut costs in every way possible. And life there is very different now. The people who still remain at the company, and many, many have left, but those who still remain say it just feels so different. And a lot of them are quite dejected because they felt such a strong sense of loyalty and ownership toward Anheuser-Busch. And it was sold out from beneath them, and now suddenly they feel like just cogs in this giant machine of productivity, and they don't feel the passion they used to feel.
Can Budweiser remain the king of beer without that family cachet, the extra oomph, a closely held corporation would put behind it? The Bushes were experts at marketing and positioning, and you bring a big corporation in and it's all dollars and cents. Will do you think Budweiser beer will remain the king of beers?
Well, the interesting thing to think about there is that, although, again, we may have thought that it was a closely held corporation since the 70s, Anheuser-Busch has not been closely held by the Bushes. It's just that the Bushes and the people who ran Anheuser-Busch understood the importance of marketing that image. And I don't think that InBev has the same type of prowess in terms of marketing that image and maintaining that sort of myth, even if it is a myth. And part of that is because InBev isn't willing to spend the money on marketing that Anheuser-Busch was. They're much more results-driven. Anheuser-Busch, under August the 3rd and August the 4th, would spend millions and millions of dollars making commercials they never used just to see if they worked. And InBev doesn't do things that way. They will test and test and test and then figure out which one commercial works and make it. They
would probably never come up with a commercial featuring three frogs that say Budweiser.
Yeah, it may be less likely that they would come up with something like that, such an organic, just out-of-the-box smash hit. But it just depends on whether your view is that sort of marketing is necessary to maintain Budweiser status. And I think we'll see in a few years. But I think there's a chance that it will just Budweiser and Bud Light and the brand image will just slowly become diluted over time, and then InBev will eventually, and as it looks for continued growth, need to look elsewhere and probably make another acquisition.
Keep buying things that have cachet, and it's hard to keep the cachet. When we come back from this break, I have the big question for Julie McIntosh, author of Dethroning the King. Actually, two questions. One's a surprise. Got to have a surprise for you. But the other is, what does the loss of our beer industry portend for the future of our economy and our business world here in the United States? We've lost control of our beer. What do you think out there? We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Julie McIntosh. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have sold our beer manufacturing companies to foreign investors. We no longer control the beer that we drink. We have thus become consumers in a world owned by producers. And so we ask Julie McIntosh, author of Dethroning the King and business writer and business observer, what on earth this portends for the future of the American business community that we no longer control almost anything anymore. What's going on with this, Julie?
Well, I think America has become a country that is trading more and more over from being a manufacturing type economy to providing services. Mm-hmm. And it's something that President Obama has talked about a lot recently. It's been in the national dialogue. Is this the right move for us to be making to deviate from our traditional manufacturing and farming roots and start just selling brain power? And what happens when the economy takes a turn for the worse, and how resilient does that make us? So certainly a lot of the people who work for Anheuser-Busch think that it's a travesty to lose manufacturing icons like this. I would say the bright side here is that in terms of brewing in particular, the craft brewing industry here in the United States is on fire right now. And I know people are very excited about that. There are a lot of other small brewers that aspire to be the next big American, brewing giant. And that's possible because Anheuser-Busch was once a small local brewer. So hopefully there are lots of little seedlings that are coming up to potentially take the place of the loss of some of these giant companies.
So hopefully we can reinvent ourselves and pick up from scratch, literally, and keep going and keep growing and keep building. So, Julie McIntosh, you've been working on this Budweiser story for a long time. Do you drink Budweiser?
I do drink Budweiser on occasion, but I have to say it's certainly not my favorite beer.
Uh-huh. Are you a fan of the craft beers?
I am, actually, yeah. I'm not a big, you know, go out in one night and drink four or five beers type person. I like to maybe have one or two. So I prefer a beer that has a more complex, hefty, you know, interesting taste, because I don't feel the need to chug a bunch of them at once.
And I guess that's really what made Budweiser famous, wasn't it? You know, where you have a beer that you could slug down a whole bunch of them.
Right, and that's good for them, because it certainly helps with sales when people are drinking many beers rather than just a couple. But, you know, they, besides drinking a whole bunch of them, they wanted to kind of present this, like, clean, crisp image, you know, on a hot day at a barbecue.
Right.
Have one of these. It's not going to weigh you down. And people, you know, it's certainly true, because the beer tastes much lighter and more watery, some people would say, than other types of beer.
And you can drink a whole six-pack at one sitting. What lesson, Julie, that did you pick up from your looking into this story?
I would say there are two. The first is, on a personal level, when it comes to family businesses, there is no such thing as too much attention to be paid to the interpersonal relationships between people at a company. And I think August the 3rd in particular just felt he could ignore how difficult
It was to be his son. Yeah.
And the second thing is that, from more of, you know, the business side of things, Anheuser-Busch, and again, this was largely when August the 3rd was running the company, chose to just completely ignore globalization and to basically pretend that if it could remain incredibly strong in the American market, it would be invincible.
And then pretending didn't work. Thanks, Julie McIntosh, author of Dethroning the King, and thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio, right here on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.